Morning. So, this is the third talk that I'm giving on deepening and strengthening meditation, building up the meditation muscle, which is not seen physically, but is experienced by self and others. We hope. So in my first talk, I talked about concentration and bare awareness and how they complement one another, and how we need concentration because sometimes with bare awareness we just get so scattered. We need to narrow the focus so we can broaden it to include all human beings who are suffering, including ourselves. So, in the second talk yesterday, I talked about impediments that get in the way. This, based on my experience with myself and others for many years, just simple little things that actually don't talk about in the sutras, like drowsiness. Anybody experience that in meditation? Mind wandering? Anybody experience that in meditation? Impatience? Physical and emotional pain? Anybody experience either of those in meditation? Well, that was yesterday. And then I talked about doubt, a little bit about doubt. And I talked about how self-doubt, extreme self-doubt, can be paralyzing, And I'm going to talk more about that today. In the last newsletter, I talked about the trance of unworthiness. That sense of unworthiness really interferes with the deepening and strengthening of our meditation. And yet it seems to be so prevalent in this culture. Katagiri Roshi just used to kind of shake his head about us in regard to that. He didn't understand it, but it's here. It's here. Possibly because we're a nation of immigrants. I don't know. But it's here, so we need to take care of it and deal with it. And so yesterday I did a couple of guided meditations on dealing with paralyzing self-doubt. And I included the Vipassana, very simple Vipassana approach of when you have something comes in that starts to get you, take over your meditation, you just notice it's a feeling, a thought, or a belief. And if it's a feeling, you just label it feeling. And then if it's a belief, you just label belief. If it's a thought, you just label it thought. Now, as long as you don't get too worried about doing that right, that's a good practice because it gives you some space, creates some space. It's a good practice. So that's yesterday and last time and the time before. So today I want to talk more about where I ended up yesterday, which is when we experience anguish or paralyzing self-doubt, what do we do? And I did a guided meditation on holding yesterday, and I'm going to do one today on holding in compassion. All of us have moments of shame, of feeling unlovable, of feeling unworthy, of feeling undeserving. All of us have moments like that. But there's no need to be paralyzed by it. And so we need to practice opening our hearts. We need to evoke compassion for that wounded part of ourselves that feels so much pain from shame, And we have a possibility to rewire the brain. That's what we do. We rewire the brain. Neuroplasticity, that's what everybody's talking about these days, right? Well, okay. We can do it. We can do it. It's been done before. We're not the first ones. So I'm going to start with one guided meditation. So if you would like to join me, and you certainly don't have to join me. It's not a requirement. It's not a mandate. I'd love to have you join me. Close your eyes. Get settled. Take one or two natural breaths and just be with your breathing. And when you're ready, bring to mind someone you love, someone you've unreservedly, unconditionally loved, someone you have loved with all your heart. Bring that person to mind. This could be a dear friend, a beloved child, a relative, a dog, a cat. Feel the love for them in your body. Feel the love that you have for them in your body. Sense the flow of love from you to them. Sense it. Keep this love and compassion toward them going. Just enjoy it. Just ride it. Just give it. And when you are ready, let it flow back to yourself. It's infinite. If it can flow to them, it can flow back to yourself. It's possible that you can let yourself receive and love. Receive the love and compassion that you extend to them. It's possible. Just take a minute to be with this, to let it go to them and come back to you. Come back to you. Feel it wherever you feel it. Possible that you can let yourself receive the care that you extend to them. Receive it yourself, the care that you extend to them. It's possible. It's also possible that you can feel loved and cared for by a larger self, the same self Buddha discovered when he awakened to his oneness with all of life. It's possible that you can feel loved and cared for by a larger self, the same self Buddha discovered when he awakened to his oneness with all of life. It's possible that his awakening may be even your awakening. It's possible. Just taking one or two more minutes to feel the love that you give coming back to you. Because anything given comes back. And just being with it and appreciating it. Okay, and when you're ready, you can just open your eyes and come back to the room, and I'll keep talking. And this is a practice. This is a practice. Doing this once is okay, but doing this once every day is better. Doing it at the beginning and the end of your meditation is best, or some other version of it, so that you can begin to rewire your neural pathways. So that's holding. And supposedly, when Buddha had his enlightenment experience, right, the 3 to 5 days that he sat just like we did before his enlightenment experience, you know, those 6 years he just did lots of other stuff, like, you know, starved himself and studied with the lofty philosophers. But then those 6 days, 3 to 6 days, he sat in zazen the way we do, with milk and, you know, took care of himself. But he was held by the banyan tree, the Bodhi tree. If you've been to India, you see a banyan tree. They're huge. It held his back. It held his back. It shaded him. It supported him. Its green leaves, its richness. So, we can do this. Holds our back. Holds our back. So, a couple of other things that we can do to help us when we're feeling not good enough, not loved, not okay. I talk about this all the time, but in this context, we can realize that whatever is coming through, can just notice it. The Diamond Sutra says, whatever is coming through is a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. That's all that, all those bad movies. That's what they are. A dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a cloud, a flash of lightning. There are a series of them that conglomerate. But if we just see the movie and stay under this, in within this banyan tree, this banyan tree is always supporting us, we're okay. We see that the movie's always changing. It's always changing. We think hopeless, but not always hopeless, because sometimes we give love to, we give affection to beings, and we can feel that affection coming back to us. I feel anger or sadness in this moment, but I don't feel sad all the time. Who feels sad all the time? That's because you're glommed on to one particular part of the movie that's just rerunning. But look at it. It's changing. You're capable of giving love and receiving love. You have that capability. It's wonderful. So we notice the shift in the movie. We notice the shift. And I want to do one more guided meditation. And this is comes from Linda Grant, Dharma teacher Linda Grant. It's about repairing. So something seems to have been, in many of us, something's been damaged neurologically, in that we just got this negativity circulating through us, dominating us. So we want to repair this damage. And instead of going to a neurosurgeon, we go to ourselves. We go to the banyan tree, right? To repair. To repair. There's a negative pairing going on in our neural pathways. We're going to repair. We're going to repair. It's really important that we repair. Meditation is about repairing. Repairing. So, I have an old shame memory, which I won't go into because I don't want to go that direction right now. I have an old shame memory. And I pair it with, well, I swear to myself, so I'm not going to tell you what I say, but you dirty, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you no good, da-da-da-da-da-da, you got it? Just watch late night TV if you want to know. Right? So that's a pairing. It's a negative pairing that I learned in adolescence, I think. I must have learned in adolescence. Probably in young adolescence. Started swearing early, right? So we want to repair. We want to take that old shame memory with a new experience of self-empathy, of self-compassion. So this means we need to evoke a memory of shame, evoke a memory of not being okay that lights up the firing in our neural network, and then pair it with self-empathy, with self-compassion. So we create, by doing this over and over again, a new circuit. We create a new circuit. So here's a... So let's, those of you who would like to, I invite you to join me in a second guided meditation. And in this one, just place your hand on your heart. Just place your hand on your heart and breathe deeply. Deep, breathe deeply. And evoke a memory of being loved. Evoke just a single memory of being loved at some time by someone, by something. Just evoke that memory. Let that memory come in. Enter your heart. Be with you. See it, feel it, taste it, touch it. Let it be with you. And when you're ready, if you'd like to, you can evoke an old memory when you didn't feel good enough, when you weren't up to the task, when things were pretty bad, when it felt awful. Is it possible for you to hold those two memories together in a larger awareness? Is it possible for you to hold those two memories together in a larger acceptance under this banyan tree? In a larger acceptance? You might even say to yourself, it's okay. I'm really okay. And if these aren't the words you need to hear, you might say something else to yourself. Allow yourself to experience the larger view, the larger view, the goodness of your true nature, the goodness of your clear sky mind, holding the smaller view, holding the cloud, naturally, easily, just holding, just being present, not trying to control. And I don't know what that feels like for you, but this is also a practice that you can do in some way, shape, or form, over and over, because the brain is plastic. It's plastic. And when you're ready, you can come back to the room, and I will probably continue talking. It's more than likely. So, doubt, self-doubt, which for some reason seems to be crippling. I mean, I've been meditating for my whole adult life, and I not only experienced it myself, I have so many friends and so many students who have been crippled by self-doubt. But we can do this. We can do this. Banyan tree's over here, always here supporting us. It's always here supporting everyone, all beings. Beings who are suffering even more than us. But if we're not generous to ourselves, it's hard to be generous to others. Just hard. Okay, now I want to move on and talk about a different kind of doubt, which is in Zen practice, not negative, but positive. And sometimes gets confused with this putting down, I don't deserve to be loved down. And that's called by Hakuin and by Bonke and by the great Chinese Zen masters, the great doubt. The great doubt. And the great doubt is a form of meditation. Just like concentration meditation, bare awareness meditation, great doubt. But to do the great doubt practice, you have to heal inside enough to do it. So it doesn't get confused with your feeling of impoverishment, feeling that you're not okay at some base level. So the great doubt, we realize that our stories, this is when the great doubt comes in, we realize that our stories don't support us. And we question everything, including our so-called self. We question that. And that questioning can drive us to deeper and deeper asking. So we don't have to get caught on not being good enough. We just have enough trust, enough aspiration in the practice that we bypass that and question, look into what's going on here. What is this so-called self? What are these stories? Not to get rid of the stories, but what is it? Who is it? And the great Zen teachers say that great doubt can only rise from great aspiration and great trust. There has to be an aspiration to open up to your sense of connectedness with all life, an aspiration in your heart, and a trust that you can actually do that, that you can crack open the shell of your little self and open up. All it takes is trust and aspiration, and then you just do it over and over again. And you complement it with these other practices when you start putting yourself down. Because when you get into I'm no good, then you just want to give up. So this is not it. This is great doubt that comes out of our really looking into what is this? Who am I? What's going on here? So here's Bonke talking in what, the 15th or 16th century in Japan. Long ago, when Nanyue went to the sixth patriarch and was asked, Who is it that's just come to see me? He was totally bewildered. His doubt about it lasted for 8 long years. This is a typical Chinese Zen story, right? Finally, he sat with that questioning, the teacher, for 8 years. He did. Finally, he let go of everything and opened up to a wonderful stillness, to a wonderful stillness that included everything, that included everyone. When asked what he had awakened to, he said, "Whatever I say would miss the mark." Again, typical Chinese Zen. Whatever I would say would miss the mark. Dogen would have a lot to say, but these Chinese Zen teachers, not so much. And then Bonke continues, "People nowadays see that they need to have doubt because people in the past did." So this is part of the Zen tradition. It goes back to the very beginning. And then, you know, we think this is, you had to have that. Now I've got to have that. I've got to add that to myself. You know, not only am I no good, I don't doubt enough. So I need to develop more confidence and more doubt at the same time. You know, because we're trying to figure this life out. We're trying to improve. But we go all tangled up. People nowadays say they need to have doubt because people in the past did. So they cultivate a doubt. But that's merely an imitation of a doubt, not a real one. So the day never comes when they arrive at a real resolution. It's as if you were going off looking for something you hadn't really lost, pretending you have. So in Rinzai Zen, this dot is really emphasized, but also in Soto Zen, we just don't talk about it much. If you read Dogen's biography, you learn about his 12 years of doing meditation every day and doubting and doubting and doubting. But we love others. We know how to love others, and we're learning how to love ourselves. What keeps us separate from them? What keeps us separate from the people in Black Lives Matter and the police? What keeps us separate from them? Maybe we love the people with Black Lives Matter and we hate the police. Maybe we love the police and we hate the people from Black Lives Matter. What keeps us separate from them? What is that? Who is that? Who is that I that's mostly defined by fear? Face up to it. That little I is mostly defined by fear. If you say, no, I want to hang out with you, but I don't believe you. I don't believe you. Who is it? Who is it? What's that wonderful stillness that Tim is always talking about? Is that out of reach for me? Did Tim just get it because he was a good boy or sat for 82 years? Is it out of reach for me? My depression is so bad. Maybe it's out of reach for me. So that doubt, together with the trust, the aspiration to feel joined to all life, to join each other, to live together, with honesty, with heartfeltness, that aspiration. Is it really possible for you to experience the restfulness of being just where you are? Is it possible? We're always talking about it. I'm always talking about it. Is it possible? Look into that. Look into that. We're always banging up against the wall of the boundary of our small self. And we want to crack through this little shell. We think we want to crack through, but we actually don't want to crack through because that fear protects us. Without that fear, what's going to happen? Ooh. Even if we have lots of self-confidence and we've done all this wonderful guided meditation to not be totally hopeless, still, ooh. So they say in Chinese Zen, the teacher pecks from the outside. The little baby chick pecks from the inside till something happens. We don't know. But if you keep pecking and teacher keeps pecking, something happens. Something wonderful. You need to trust that. You need to trust that. Aspire to that. Don't make it a mandate. I have to. But let it come out of your heart. Let it come out of your heart. Ta Hui said in 1089, the 1,000 doubts, the 10,000 doubts, just one great doubt. What is this? Who am I? What is this? Who am I? What is this? Who am I? Who is it that's not at peace? Who is it that wants peace? Who is it that put their butt on the cushion for a whole day and a half in retreat here? Who is it? What is it? So we can settle into this doubt. We can settle into this hunger that we feel. Rather than escaping into false hungers and phony satisfactions. And our Zen practice actually naturally fosters this doubt. Naturally fosters it. It awakens us to it. And we can pour ourselves completely into it. So that's why I say there's concentration meditation, bare awareness meditation, and doubt meditation. what is this? Who am I? But not, just sit stillness. Not growling. Just sit stillness, just in openness. Not with a sense of brutality, with a sense of kindness. Who am I? Who am I? Because if you're not kind to yourself, then you're going back into your original self-recrimination doubt, which is not what this is about. And you could slide into that. That's why working with a teacher or mentor is helpful. Can be helpful. Hawkwind in the 18th century said, at the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. Right. At the bottom of great doubt lies great awakening. Ha-ya said in the 5th century, if you doubt fully, you will awaken fully. The Pali Canons, 400, 300 before the contemporary era, they don't talk about doubt. They talk about, who am I? Who are you? Look into this. Look into this. So, we do this by remaining open to what's in our heart, not by trying to cultivate some special doubt. Just remain open to what's in your heart. Embrace it. If you're in great pain, don't separate it from it. Just be with it. Enter into it. Open your heart to it. Who is suffering? Who is in great pain? Who is feeling discouraged? Who is feeling not okay? Who is feeling okay? But usually when you're feeling okay, you don't want to look into it. So you should feel partly not okay. You need to feel partly not okay. That's part of the doubt. You feel part. I just want you to feel good enough to do this, that's all. And not get into these negative loops of neural pathways where it's like, I'm no good, I can't do this, I don't deserve to be loved. You can fall into the great doubt into that, from the great doubt into that. Then do some of these open-hearted ones to come back. I have a good friend who's always telling me, not always telling me, but he says sometimes, I'm not myself today. Oh, I just don't feel like myself. I'm not myself today. He's not a Buddhist, and I don't want to correct him because, I want to be his friend. You know, if you go around correcting people, you're not going to have many friends. That's not what our religion is about. Our religion is not about giving people advice or telling them the one true way. But anyway, I'm not myself today, Tim. Oh, yeah, okay, you're not yourself today. Well, what's going on? But I think to myself, I'll say it. He's lacking the traits with which he's familiar and which he uses to identify himself. He's got a secure pattern of habits and attitudes that is his self, and somehow that pattern of attitudes and habits is out of sync. He's not a self. And I would like to say to him, good, good, get on a cushion. But I don't. I do it to you guys instead. Because we're not into converting people here. What is there to convert people to? Just heart openness and feeling of connection with our suffering and everybody else's suffering. So this great doubt has no shame in it, because we've been engaging in our practice, in our Buddhist practice, in a purification process, a natural process, in which, as the Yogacara Buddhists say, we've been gathering wholesome provisions. In Yogacara Buddhism, I've been talking about that lately, we have all these negative seeds, all these negative emotional memories that we project on the world. But if we do some good things, we develop some positive seeds. We need enough positive seeds to practice. So we practice, we're gathering wholesome provisions. The wholesome provisions are the paramitas. We're being generous to ourselves. We're gathering them. We're practicing. And if you're not used to being generous to yourself, you should practice that. If you're not used to being generous to your wife, you should practice that, or your husband, or your partner. We're practicing it. We're practicing being generous to all beings, including ourselves. We're practicing virtuous behavior. Virtuous behavior toward ourselves. You know, you wouldn't treat your dog the way you treat yourself sometimes. You think about what you'd say to yourself. Would you say that to your dog, to your loving dog? Would you? To the dog that you really love? Would you say to your dog what you say to yourself? I don't know. How many would? Not very many. Maybe you don't like dogs, but if you like dogs. So, we're gathering wholesome provisions. Generosity, virtuous behavior, patience, eternal practice. This takes patience. It takes patience. This neuroplasticity is not neurofluidity. If it were neurofluidity, that wouldn't be so cool anyway. We're rewiring. Patience, patience, and wholehearted effort. The fourth of the paramitas, wholehearted effort. Regardless of how down we feel, we get up and come here on Sunday. We get up and come here. That's all. That's all. Or something. Regardless of how hopeless we feel about what's happening between blacks and whites right now in the United States, we go to North Minneapolis and support some people. And we hang out by the police with the police and support them. We do that. We do that. We do something. We do something. And of course, we also practice meditation. We practice bare awareness, where we let these powerful memories, and you really need to do a retreat to get a sense of what I'm talking about. We let these powerful memories, these thoughts, these emotions surface and dissipate in the quiet stillness of our meditation. They dissipate. The seeds do not turn into weeds. They just dissipate. They just blow away. So, as a result of this, we're able to, as Fritz Perl said, lose our mind and come to our senses. Lose our mind and come to our seconds. Now, I wouldn't follow Fritz Perls if I were you. I'm an old guy, so I remember Fritz Perls. But it's a good practice to lose your mind and come to your senses. You don't have to follow him. These are your senses, right? Your senses. And you know, your mind will always come back. You don't. It's not like you're cutting your head off. Your mind. You need your mind. Your mind's wonderful. But this is about awakening to the wonderful presence that's right here. It's always right here. With no projections. There's a possibility. There's a possibility. You may doubt this. But if you have an aspiration, there's a possibility that you might have a moment of no projections. A release from the sense of a separate self. When you're not projecting, that sense of a separate self is released. And there's a feeling of A-okay. Or something. There's no even thought about it. There's just a feeling. No thought, just a feeling. So through concentration meditation, through bare awareness, through great doubt, we can strengthen and deepen our sense of being joined with each other, working and playing with each other. And the cogitating side of our brain stops for a moment, and we come to rest right here with no concern. We can all do this. If you had met me when I was 20 years old, you would have thought, that guy could never do this. You really? The guy is totally out to lunch. Well, I'm still totally out to lunch, but I enjoy it now. And, of course, everybody wants an experience like this. When I say that, then you want that experience. Yes, of course you do. And aspiration for that experience is good. And it will engender some great doubt. And that will engender you, I hope, to just do your meditation with really wholeheartedness. And if you do have that experience, a little enlightenment, a little kensho, a little satori, or a great big one, it might be transformative and it might not. And if you don't have it, you can transform without having it. Because the transformation isn't about the special experience. Although the special experience can help you. It can help you. But it can also hinder you. You can say, I got it. And parade around the Zendo as the enlightened being, right? I got it. Well, then you're just bringing more bad seeds in, right? More like, I got it. You guys don't have it. Maybe you'll get it someday, Jeff. If you quit doing all this protesting, just come sit with me. Jeez. right? So to have this experience is wonderful. Sometimes you will have it if you practice. Everybody will. But to let go of it completely, come back to your wholesome provisions. We're gathering wholesome provisions and we're keeping them in our backpack. We're not just having some great enlightenments and then going around proselytizing. On our backpack we have generosity, we have patience, we have loving kindness. We have our effort just to be here with each other. Then our enlightenment is not dry. Suzuki Roshi talked about dry enlightenment, my teacher, because everybody was taking acid in those days. Any of you old enough to know about that? Everybody was taking acid. They'd come to the retreats having taken acid. They take 200 milligrams or four. How many, they talk to me, how many milligrams of acid should I take before we start a session? And I said, well, Suzuki never told us to do that. That's but they took it anyway. They took it anyway. That was a long time ago, but I hear people are doing this again. What goes around comes around, right? It's fine. No problem if you want to do it. But this is about being with others and taking care of ourselves. So dry enlightenment means nothing. It's just something you hang on the wall. It's like, you love a deer and you kill the deer and you put the antlers on the wall. That's not loving a deer. So I want to end with the closing lines from the Heart Sutra, which I have been chanting every day for more than 40 years. We chant it here every morning. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva relies on complete wisdom. And thus the mind is without hindrance. Without hindrance, there is no fear. Far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. So with nothing to attain, there's nothing to attain. We're not trying to go anyplace else and get something. We don't need to kill a deer and put an antler on the wall. I got this enlightenment or this result. With nothing to attain, a bodhisattva, someone who wants to be here for all beings, to support all beings, which includes myself and my wife and my dog. Often we leave ourselves and our wives and our dogs out of this because we're just habituated to them. They're just old news, right? They're old news. So we come back. We take care of them, right? Take care of them. And thus the mind is without hindrance, with nothing to attain, nothing to get. The mind is without hindrance. And without hindrance, there's no fear. Hey, the fear is gone. Hey, it's possible. It's possible. Far beyond all inverted views. Suzuki Roshi translated this as topsy-turvy views. That was his translation. And I said to him, what's a topsy-turvy view? And he said, well, any view you get attached to is topsy-turvy. That was a good Zen answer, wasn't it? Beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. This one, that one. Each of you realize nirvana. As I said last time, nirvana is not a special deal. Etymologically, all nirvana means is to cool by blowing, by breathing, by being present with our breath, with our bodies, with our sensations, with our feelings, regardless of how out of whack they are. We cool, we blow, and we blow out. That's the second definition of nirvana. We blow out this sense of little Tim who's afraid and has to protect himself. We blow that out. That gets blown out. It comes back later, but when it comes back later, there's more of a lightness to it, more of an openness, more of a plasticity to it. We rewire the brain without even trying to rewire it. It rewires itself. It rewires itself. Hey, what a deal. So that's what I want to say for this morning, and I'd be glad to take a couple questions or have a couple comments or whatever you guys would like on this.
I have a question of clarification.
Sure.
You give the definition of nirvana as to cool by blowing. What meaning do you give to the idea of to cool?
To cool. Well, we're cooling down our agitation. We're cooling down our nervousness. We're cooling down our not okayness about being right here with what's going on. We're cooling that down. That's what we're doing. And we're not trying to cool it down. We're just blowing through our breathing. Breathe. Breath breathes. The blowing is going on. All you have to do is be with it. Surf your breath. Surf it. You know, sometimes there are a lot of waves. Sometimes there are no waves. Just cool it by blowing.
So calming.
Yes, calming. Blowing gently. Blowing with an open heart. Yeah.
I had to laugh at my own experience that phrase, lose your mind and come to your senses.
Yeah.
I always thought it was like, lose your mind and think about it more rationally, like figure it out mentally.
Uh-oh.
And now I realize senses mean like your senses.
That's right.
So that's what made me
laugh. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it means your senses.
I understand the phrase.
Yeah. Yeah, we think we should lose our mind and get some common sense.
Get some common sense.
Yes. Better to have uncommon sense, you guys. Uncommon sense, which is just feeling and hearing and being alive. What else? Jeffrey.
Last weekend I had the opportunity to participate in a session organized by the Ramsey County Police. And for about 48 hours I was their guest.
Was it called a session?
Well, in retrospect, that's the label I'm putting on it.
Okay.
The participants in many ways were kind of a photo-negative version of the people in this room, which is to say, most of them are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
There were three people in wheelchairs. One of them was an amputee. They were all black. One of the brothers who also participated, his name is Eugene, he generously shared a cell with me. And we got to know each other a little bit. He'd been arrested on a drug charge, I don't know, a year ago or more, perhaps, and had been found guilty and so forth, put on parole, and the conditions of the parole were that he had to make three visits to the judge every week, three visits to drug rehab, and then there was a seventh thing that he also had to do. And he missed one of those visits, so he was in violation, and he was pulled back in. And he, at that point, had not yet seen the judge to know how long he was going to be there. His girlfriend was in the last stages of pregnancy and about to give birth to their daughter.
Working hard?
It's very difficult for people inside this particular institution to contact people outside. You have no money.
So it was a real session then?
It was. Right. Our meditation robes were orange jumpsuits. But, and in fact, you basically are stripped naked before you are given the jumpsuit. So you have no money. You're given 3 free phone calls to contact outside people, but then you have to find some way of setting up an account that somebody else has to do that.
So Jeff, I need you to do this in this much time. Okay.
He's calling his girlfriend to find out what their situation is, and she's not answering.
Mm-hmm.
So his thought was that she's in the hospital delivering their daughter.
Mm-hmm. So you were there for him. Good for you. Good for you.
He was there for me.
Uh-huh. What, was he there for you?
Uh-huh.
Well, wonderful. You were there for each other. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Thank you. I think we should move on now. But thank you for your attentiveness and your practice.